Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, August 1st, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. 10 candidates running for Eastern Washington's District 5 congressional seat to replace McMorris Rogers, who's retiring. There's 6 Republicans and 4 Democrats. 3 candidates running for Representative Joe Schmick's 9th District legislative seat. Voters will eliminate all but 2 in next week's primaries. Schmick is a Republican. There's 2 Democrats running in the race. U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials indicate changes in grizzly Endangered Species Act listing in the next few months. And undocumented immigrants contribute millions to Idaho's economy. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. A high-ranking U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service official has indicated in a lawsuit settlement that the agency may revise its current grizzly bear listing under the Endangered Species Act or begin rulemaking to remove the bear from Endangered Species Act protections altogether by January 31st of next year. Grizzlies are classified as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The Lewiston Tribune reports the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is reviewing petitions from Wyoming and Montana asking grizzlies no longer be protected as threatened in certain areas of those states. Wyoming wants delisting in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and Montana wants to delist grizzlies in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, which is a large mountainous area that includes Glacier National Park. The agency recently rejected Idaho's petition to end grizzly protections in the lower 48 states. Idaho is claiming the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service should have only listed grizzly bears under the Endangered Species Act in narrow geographic areas covering distinct populations when they first listed grizzlies in 1975. Idaho Governor Brad Little said in a news release a few months ago, "Idaho and neighboring states have worked for more than 40 years in a broad-based effort to support and sustain healthy and reasonable grizzly populations in our states, but legal and bureaucratic gridlock has kept robust populations of grizzly bears unnecessarily under Endangered Species Act protection. The settlement provides a path to escape regulations that are not necessary in Idaho." It's unclear what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will do next. They could begin the process of removing grizzlies from Endangered Species Act protections around Glacier and Yellowstone National Parks, as Wyoming and Montana has requested. They could grant Idaho's request to begin working to delist grizzlies in all of the lower 48 states, or it could respond to Idaho's challenge by prescribing specific limited places where grizzlies would be protected. Adam Rissian of Wild Earth Guardians told the Lewiston Tribune it would be indefensible to delist grizzlies everywhere in the lower 48 or even throughout Idaho, but he notes court documents indicate that's a possibility. Rissian said, "I would anticipate maybe a complete overhaul of how the service is approaching grizzly bear recovery in the lower 48 states, and that overhaul is deeply concerning." Joe Suzwalak of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wrote in an email to the paper, "The agency will consider the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem 12-month finding, the Northern Continental Divide Ecosystem 12-month finding, and the proposed rule changing or eliminating Endangered Species Act listing for grizzly bears in the lower 48 states simultaneously. Biologists consider the Bitterroot Mountains ecosystem in Idaho as suitable grizzly habitat, although grizzlies have not established a population there. Grizzlies sometimes pass through the area. Montana and Wyoming have about 1,000 grizzlies each. Idaho has 200 grizzly bears in 3 areas: the Selkirk Mountains near the U.S.-Canada border, the Cabinet Mountains northwest of Sandpoint, and in the Island Park area west of Yellowstone National Park. Idaho government officials claim grizzlies are fully recovered in Idaho. Two Democrats are running in the District 9 legislative race for the seat now held by Republican Joe Schmick of Colfax. Voters will advance two of those candidates to the November general election in next week's primary, in which mail-in ballots are due Tuesday. The two Democrats are Arianna Arends and Pam Kollmeyer. Both of those candidates live in a small corner of southeastern Spokane in the sprawling District 9, which includes all of Whitman, Adams, Lincoln, Assotin, Garfield, and Columbia counties, as well as the southern part of Spokane County. Only incumbent Joe Schmick and Democrat Pam Kollmeyer showed up for a Pullman League of Women Voters Forum for candidates in that race July 15th. Here's Kollmeyer's opening statement, followed by Joe Schmick.
I'm Dr. Pam Kollmeyer. I am running for the 9th Legislative District, Position 2. And I'm also a physician and an attorney. I live on the South Hill of Spokane. My husband, Dr. Stephen Du, and I raised our 4 children there. We've lived on the South Hill for 19 years. And we actually went through that redistricting. We went from being in the 6th to the 9th. So you're my representative right now. Thank you very much for your service. I decided to run because I have a deep understanding of medicine and law. Putting the two together is my passion and my focus. I practiced emergency medicine for about 15 years. I trained in Chicago, so I've seen some bad stuff. But actually, the thing that broke my heart the most was seeing mental health issues in children. And I will say right now, they are struggling. And we need someone to step up and do better to provide access to our mental health services. I know that all too well because one of our own adult children died by suicide a year ago. And I am committed to doing all I can to make our system better. But I need your help. I will also say my commitment to public health goes beyond mental health. I went to medical school in Nebraska. My grandparents were farmers. I graduated from a small town high school. My husband did as well, but I didn't know him back then. Probably a good thing. he's a great guy, though. But my roots are rural. So even though I've lived even in Chicago, I have rural roots. And our favorite vacations were on our grandparents' farm. Riding the tractor, loved it. So I have a big passion for rural health, which is struggling. I'm very committed to improving access to broadband all across our state. Because number one, that'll put telehealth in everyone's room if they want it. Number two, it also will help increase jobs in rural areas. I worked virtually for the last 2.5 years for the Washington Medical Commission. I don't anymore, but I was based out of Olympia, you know, in Tumwater. Yet I worked in Spokane the whole 2.5 years. And the reality is it doesn't just matter then if it's a Safeway or a Walmart that lives in your town. You have access to all kinds of job opportunities, which we need. Because families are struggling. So that'll help with jobs, it'll help with health care. I am committed to trying to do all I can to protect rural health, to improve mental health access, and part of that is addressing provider burnout. Because I don't know if you tried to find a primary care doc recently, but when my husband tried about a year ago, they said it's 8 months. Good luck. So I need your help. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Representative Joe Schmick. I had the honor of being appointed in 2007 to an open seat where the current representative stepped down, take another job, and I have been there ever since. I farmed for 35 years on my own. I was a second-generation farmer. Sadly, on the day of my mother's funeral, my siblings informed me that we're selling the land. And I got outvoted, and I miss the land. Because you grow up as a farmer, it becomes part of you. And I miss that part, don't miss the business end of farming, because it's a tough life. We had several other, been married 42 years. And My wife and I had a couple other businesses to support that farming habit, and that's how we stayed on the farm. Currently, I am the ranking member on Health and Wellness, Healthcare and Wellness Committee. I sit on the Natural Resource, Ag and Natural Resource Committee, which is pretty important to our area, and I sit on the Appropriations Committee in the House of Representatives. I also sit on the Telehealth Collaborative, so we are bringing medicine and advancing it to all people to make it easier to access and to have more providers, so that people have access to care that they so desperately need. I also sit on the Universal Healthcare Commission as the representative from our caucus, and so I sit on that and a number of other committees as assigned. Frankly, the reason why I ran in the first time and the reason why I continue to run is that I saw all our small communities suffering and I wanted to do something about it. And that's why I run and I work hard at it. And so thank you all for coming, braving the heat. Looking forward to your questions tonight and we'll have a good discussion. Thank you for coming.
That was Republican Representative Joe Schmick of Colfax. He represents District 9 in the Washington legislature. And before that, you heard from his challenger, Democrat Pam Kohlmeyer. Those were the two candidates at the Pullman League of Women Voters Candidates Forum for the race for the District 9 House seat now held by Joe Schmick, July 15th. A third candidate in the race, Ariana Arends, was not present. One question from the July 15th forum was about climate change. Outgoing Governor Jay Inslee has made carbon emissions and climate change mitigation a priority during his terms in office. Here are the answers from the questions, first from Pam Kohlmeyer and then from Joe Schmick.
What is your position on decreasing carbon usage to slow down climate temperature increases? Dr. Pam, you start.
That is a loaded question. I would be very open to getting opinions from all sorts of experts on this. The fact that we're in the air conditioning, thank goodness, right? It's like, 96 degrees outside? So you crank up the air conditioner, but what is that doing to our environment in the long run? Hard to know, probably not good. And that's tough too, not to bring it back to the dam issue, but the dams, they do offer clean energy. And I'm not saying that's a reason why the Fed should keep it, but that is one thing to consider. If we're trying so hard to limit carbon emissions, that is one thing that doesn't do that. So I do think that it is a tough issue. We need to try to do better with trying to control our carbon footprint. And I think in Washington as a whole, we do a pretty awesome job. As a whole, not every individual person, but as a whole. The tough thing is that we can only control what we can control, right? So even as irritated as I am, almost every time when I go to the grocery store, I forget my bags in my car. Right? Even something simple like that. But I say, no, don't give me a bag. It's not because of the 8 cents. It's because I'm embarrassed that I can't get in that, habit yet. Right? But I'll get there, But I don't want to waste the bags because I don't want to, increase to our footprint of all kinds of badness. But yeah, it is something that we need to be very aware of and do what we can to help protect our environment. Because the reality is, especially with such a rural area, we need to have a good environment, right? You look at the 9th district, it's absolutely enormous. And you want this to be here for your grandkids and your great-grandkids and the generations to come.
In Washington State, our amount of carbon dioxide emissions for the whole year is the amount of increase in China for 1 month. So we are doing a decent job. Has our carbon emissions increased? Yes, they have, and a majority of that is constituted around transportation. Think of the freeways up and down the I-5 corridor and how many people sit there on the roads. Cars idling, just idling along, waiting to move. The Department of Transportation has made a policy of congestion is not the top of their list. And I tend to think it should be. How do we eliminate the congestion so you don't have all this, all these cars in one spot, idling, emitting? And that's just one suggestion, one thing. But I think we need to be cognizant of what we're putting in the air. And the choices that you make, choices that I make, I don't need to run the store for one thing. No, I should have a list of things. I don't need to do that, but that was a choice I made. And I think that every one of us need to be conscious of that so that we can have our part in helping that. And I think that that's going to be the part we need to rally around. What can I do today so that I'm not putting carbon dioxide in the air?
That was Republican Representative Joe Schmick of Colfax, preceded by a challenger, Pam Kohlmeyer of Spokane. They're running for the District 9 legislative seat now held by Joe Schmick. One question at the forum touched on DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. Here are the candidates again.
I'm concerned about legislative policies that have dictated to local school districts about DEI, sexual education, and other controversial subjects. What are your views? Dr. Pam.
So I'm the mother of a child who was transgender and non-binary. That's the one that died by suicide. And I will say my commitment to DEI education is deep. I served on the board of a private school in Spokane for the last 12 years. I was the board chair for the last three. And we passed our first ever gender inclusive policy at the school to help make sure that all kids feel accepted. And I will say, when we were debating it, some people would say, well, if people want to be transgender. And I said, it's not that people want to be transgender, they are transgender. What they want is to be accepted, just like everyone else, right? So DEI is important. It's something that has to start in schools because we have to learn how to not just accept other people, but to be with each other, to really belong.
I think that should be a local school board decision. We have moved so many things to the state level, the office of OSPI's office, and that we've lost a lot of the control that the local school boards have and what authority that they have. Government at a local level responds best to their constituents whom they serve at that level. And I think that this should be an issue taken on by every single school board and talked about, but should be done at a local level.
That was Republican Representative Joe Schmick of Colfax speaking at a Pullman League of Women forum. Pullman League of Women Voters Forum, July 15th, held at Neal Public Library. The third candidate in the race, Democrat Arianna Arends of Spokane, was not present at the League of Women Voters Forum. Voters will eliminate one of the candidates and two will advance to the November general election after next week's primary. In the other District 9 House seat race, incumbent Republican Mary Dye of Pomeroy is running and has a Democratic opponent, Patrick Miller of Cheney. House members in Washington serve two-year terms. District 9 Republican State Senator Mark Schessler of Ritzville is running unopposed this year for a four-year term. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as gyros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
The estimated 35,000 undocumented immigrants who live in Idaho are supporting the state's economy with their labor and spending. the Idaho Farm Bureau Federation, the Idaho Dairymen's Association, and the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry asked the University of Idaho McClure Center for Public Policy Research to report on undocumented immigrants' contributions to the state, and the center produced a report in June called Idaho at a Glance, Unauthorized Immigrants and Idaho's Economy. The authors of the report did not have complete data for recent years, so they had to work with older data for much of their analysis. They found undocumented immigrants in Idaho had $570 million available to spend in 2019. The most recent year data was available on undocumented immigrants' tax payments in Idaho was 2014. The report showed that year undocumented immigrants in the state paid $26.3 million in sales, property, and state income tax. The report says undocumented immigrants are key to filling jobs in Idaho's economy, particularly in agriculture, hospitality, and construction. The report found that 92% of the undocumented workers living in Idaho are working-age adults, 86% are in the workforce, 78% are from Mexico, 58% speak English well, and 48% have a high school diploma. Idaho Dairymen's Association CEO Rick Narabout testified against two anti-immigrant bills before the state legislature this year. The association reports 90% of Idaho's dairy workers are foreign-born and Spanish-speaking, 78% are from Mexico, 11% are from the U.S., and 11% are from Central America. Narabout told the Idaho Capital Sun, "The reality is it's been decades since the domestic population has wanted to work the jobs that agriculture provides. Agricultural jobs are going to be manual labor. We pay competitive wages, but they're not easy jobs. The domestic workforce typically is going to take a pass on them and pursue other jobs that are going to be easier." House Bill 615 would have outlawed giving unauthorized immigrants public assistance. The House Health and Welfare Committee voted 7-5 to kill the bill after members of both parties noted it would hurt unauthorized mothers and children seeking vaccines, prenatal care, or food assistance. The sponsors were Republican Representatives Jordan Redman of Coeur d'Alene and Josh Tanner of Eagle, who said they wanted to remove an incentive for unauthorized immigrants to come to Idaho. House Bill 753 would have created a new crime called illegal entry that the state could enforce in lieu of federal immigration authorities. Texas has a similar law on the books. Republican Representative Jerome Crane of Nampa introduced the bill late in the session, and the House passed it 53-15, but it did not come before the Senate. There are 10 candidates vying to replace Republican Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers in Washington's 5th Congressional District. McMorris Rogers is retiring. Voters will narrow the field down to 2 in next week's primary. 6 are Republicans and 4 are Democrats. There is a 5th Democrat on the ballot, Bobby Bennett Walton, who has dropped out. Washington has top 2 open primaries, meaning that all voters, no matter which party they belong to, can vote in them, and the top 2 vote-getters advance to the November general election. Here's a rundown of the candidates in the race. There's a scramble among the Republican candidates over who can most identify with Donald Trump. Ferry County Commissioner and State Senator Brian Dantzel has a leg up on that one. In 2017, Trump appointed Dantzel to an advisory role at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and later the National Economics Council. The 41-year-old Dantzel has the endorsement of the Spokane County Republican Party and the Washington State Republican Party. He is one of two candidates in the race who is an election denier, claiming Joe Biden was not legitimately elected in 2020, a position which led to the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Another Republican in the race is current Spokane County Treasurer and former State Senator Michael Baumgartner. With $617,000 in campaign funds, the 48-year-old Baumgartner leads among Republicans in the congressional race. According to the Inlander, that's close to double the amount Jacqueline Maycomer has on hand, who is second in the fundraising category among the Republicans. Baumgartner supports the idea of eliminating state government agencies through consolidation. Jacqueline Maycomer is a former state legislator from the 7th Legislative District in the far northeast corner of Washington. The 44-year-old Maycomer has the endorsements of the Washington Council of Police and Sheriffs and the National Rifle Association, and is a former police officer herself, having worked for the El Paso County Sheriff's Office in Texas. She says her legislative priorities will be creating a high school apprenticeship program, capping insulin prices, and providing more mental health support for first responders. Right-wing Spokane City Councilmember Jonathan Bingle is a COVID denier. The Spokane City Council censured him in 2021 for refusing to wear a mask to meetings. The 37-year-old Bingle says pandemic restrictions shut down his trivia events company, although it's unclear how many of his clients might have survived without the COVID distancing and mask restrictions. He interprets the restrictions as his elected leaders failing him. Bingle is against reproductive freedom and said one of his priorities is, quote, reviving the American spirit through a return to our Judeo-Christian roots. Right-wing radio host Renee Holiday is a former aide to former State Representative Matt Shea, who the investigative firm Ramparts named as involved in domestic terrorism for his role in the 2016 Malheur Wildlife Refuge takeover. The Inlander reports Holiday mentioned the words communist and communism 55 times during their interview with her. She has written two books with claims communists are working through the United Nations to infiltrate the U.S. in a plot to destroy individual freedom. The sixth Republican in the race is a moderate. Rick Valentine Flynn says the Republican Party is no longer recognizing its roots in fiscal conservatism and is instead focused on ideology. The 48-year-old Flynn is a disabled veteran and a farmer. He says he thinks the Veterans Administration should be eliminated and veterans should instead get their treatment through the Medicaid system. Of the four Democratic candidates in the race, Community Health Association of Spokane gynecologist Dr. Bernadine Bank has a slim fundraising lead with $239,000 in contributions. The 64-year-old Bank said the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade spurred her to run for Congress, as did a bill before the Alabama legislature last year that would have charged women who terminate pregnancies with murder. Former Spokane County Democratic Party Chair Carmela Conroy was overseas as a U.S. Diplomatic Corps officer until 2020. Two prominent Spokane-area Democratic legislators have endorsed Conroy. They are Representative Marcus Richelli and Senator Andy Billig. She says withholding U.S. aid to Israel could hurt what she calls the security umbrella in the region. This year is the second time Anne-Marie Danimas has run for Congress in the 5th District. The 50-year-old Danimas ran in 2022. The Inlander quoted her writing on X, formerly Twitter, "I'm so tired of naysaying, crying Democrats. If y'all haven't noticed, Biden is running against an effing Nazi." The fourth Democratic candidate in the 5th Congressional District race is Matthew Weldy of Liberty Lake, who spent 10 years as a domestic violence prosecutor. The 47-year-old Weldy said, "I fight for women's rights in the arena of domestic violence every day in court. An extension of that is fighting for their reproductive and privacy rights." He also said he grew up in a labor household and supports organized labor. Three of the Democratic candidates declared their candidacy before Kathy McMorris Rogers' surprise announcement that she would not run for an 11th term, but none of the Republicans in the race did. Bernadine Bank, Carmela Conroy, and Anne-Marie Denimis were the only three candidates in the race prior to McMorris Rogers' announcement. The Spokesman Review published questionnaire responses from 9 out of the 10 candidates, which showed all 4 Democrats in the race support federal codification of a woman's right to reproductive health and abortion. Questionnaire results show Republicans Jonathan Bingell, Renee Holiday, and Jacqueline Maycomer said they would support a nationwide abortion ban. Brian Dantzel refused to answer the question but said he agreed with the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, and Michael Baumgartner said the abortion issue should be left to the states. Washington primary ballots must be postmarked by Tuesday, August 6th in order to count. There are also drop boxes in Whitman County that can take your ballot until 8 p.m. Tuesday. Voting information for the Tuesday, August 6th Washington primary. Online and mail registration has closed for the primary. Register to vote in person at the Whitman County Elections Office at 304 North Main Street in Colfax during business hours and anytime before 8 p.m. on Election Day, Tuesday, August 6th. Returning your ballot. Ballot deposit boxes are available during business hours 18 days prior to the election at the Whitman County Elections Office, 304 North Main Street in Colfax. Unstaffed ballot boxes are available 24 hours a day beginning 18 days prior to an election. They are located in the alley behind the Elections Office at 304 North Main Street in Colfax, in front of the Oaksdale Library at 103 South 1st Street in Oaksdale, adjacent to the Northwest Grain Growers Office at 33 East Front Street in St. John, at Southeast Paradise Street in Pullman, just outside Hinrichs Trading Company, and below the Rose Hours sign in the former Dismore's parking lot, 1205 North Grand Avenue in Pullman. Deadline for putting ballots in drop-off boxes is Tuesday, August 6th at 8 p.m. To check your ballot status or voting district information, go to votewa.gov. Voting assistance, election day only from 8 a.m. until 8 p.m., ballot boxes, replacement ballots, and accessible voting equipment is available at the Whitman County Elections Office, 304 North Main Street in Colfax. Accessible voting equipment is available 18 days prior to the election at Whitman County Elections Office, 304 North Main Street in Colfax. In addition, all ballots are postage paid and may be mailed from any U.S. post office location, but must be postmarked by Tuesday, August 6th in order to count.
Nurses with an expired union contract in Oregon are holding an informational picket on Friday. Negotiations on a contract with Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital in Newport started in April, but the two sides have yet to reach a deal. The nurses are represented by the Oregon Nurses Association. Their contract expired on June 30th. Brooke Clark is a registered nurse at the hospital and member of the union. She wants Samaritan to bring its pay up equal to other Samaritan hospitals. Clark also notes that about a quarter of staff are traveling nurses.
That cost is really going to eat into our budget as an organization, and that cost is going to eventually trickle down to our patients and our community.
Traveling nurses are paid more than local nurses. The Oregon Nurses Association notes Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital is one of the most profitable hospitals in the state. A bargaining session takes place on Friday. The nurses also have an informational picket planned for Friday. Samaritan did not respond before the deadline for this story. Clark says housing, childcare, and other living costs are higher in Newport. She says the hospital has struggled to stay fully staffed at times.
Even with the travelers, we still have very regular holes in our staffing that are due to the fact that we can't recruit and retain nurses out here on the coast.
Clark says the nurses at her hospital do the same work as other nurses in the Samaritan system, and their wages should reflect that.
It really comes down to just the principle of things. It comes down to treating our nurses equally, fairly, and treating us with respect.
Nurses at Samaritan Albany General Hospital reached a deal with their managers on a new contract earlier this week. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
You can listen to the radio.
You've got it right.
Listen, listen, anytime you listen, everybody's on a mission, and there ain't nothing missing when you listen to the radio.
Radio,
you got it right.
Community radio,
listen, you give a little, listen to the radio.
Radio for you, Moscow. Fight back, radio. It's 90.3 on your radio dial. Fight back.
Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for your support. So keep on listening, listening.
Fight
see
back.
Right. We're still here.
Radio,
still here.
People who have gone through the foster care system in Oregon will get a chance to help improve it. The Oregon Department of Human Services has agreed to a settlement in a class action lawsuit filed by foster children. As part of the agreement, foster youth and anyone who has aged out of care since 2019 when the suit was filed will get a chance to share their feedback about the settlement with U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken on September 12th. Emily Cooper is Legal Director for Disability Rights Oregon, one of the organizations that filed the initial lawsuit.
They have an opportunity to say, I think the state should also maybe do these other things, or the state should really focus on this. And the court and we really want to hear from these children and young adults.
A listening session is being held today at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 1 p.m. to provide instructions on how to share feedback. Cooper notes nearly 5,000 people will be eligible to participate. Those wanting to share must sign up online by August 15th or send a letter to Judge Aiken by August 16th. Cooper says the state needs to make drastic changes to the foster care system. The initial suit was filed because of concerns about kids being abused, neglected, and going without essential services. She says the state has agreed to make certain changes over the next 10 years.
Making sure that kids aren't cycling in and out of the system, going home, coming back. That's called reentry. It's making sure they have case plans within the first 2 months of entering care. Making sure they get the services like medical, dental, mental health care when they're in care.
Cooper says she shared the agreement with one of the women involved in the case, and she told Cooper she cried after reading it.
She said, because if all of these promises that are in this agreement had been kept before I entered care, I wouldn't have the scars I have. So I think this is not just for me, but every single kid like me.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
New research shows the indigenous youth comprise more than a third of the kids in Montana's foster care system, despite making up a far smaller segment of the state's overall population. Researchers say addressing the problem is challenging. Data from the National Center for Juvenile Justice show the number of indigenous youth comprise 30% of the kids in foster care, despite making up just 10% of the Montana population. Child trends researcher Dina Aroundhim, who's also a member of the Cherokee Nation, says a combination of factors is driving the disparity, but it often comes down to a lack of child oversight.
Child neglect can lead a family to be engaged with the child welfare system and result in a child being removed from the home. We wonder if that is more a question about the resources available to families and if the solutions should be different than removal.
Aroundhim says solutions have been hard to achieve in Montana, but researchers are exploring kinship and other family-based support systems that have shown hints of success in the past. A 10-year data analysis by the Montana Free Press shows that Native children are placed in foster care at roughly 5 times the rate of white children. The juvenile justice data show that Native American kids in Montana far outpace any other racial group in the child welfare system. Aroundhim says, in addition to family-based solutions, making resources available to struggling families is also important so they can make what would seem like easy decisions.
Getting a job may not be so simple as, like, yes, take the job because it offers greater income for your family, but taking that job requires you to find childcare. And if there's limited childcare available in the community, who are you leaving your child with?
There has been a national effort in recent years to keep kids in their home when it's safe to do so, but despite those efforts, the number of Indigenous kids in the Montana foster care system has continued to grow. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, the National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat warning for eastern and central Washington and northern and north central Idaho. In effect until 8 p.m. Saturday, very hot temperatures, high temperatures throughout the region, 94 to 109. The hottest temperatures will be on Friday. Limited overnight relief with low temperatures in the mid-60s to mid-70s. Heat will increase the risk of heat-related illnesses, especially for those without effective cooling or adequate hydration. Drink plenty of fluid, stay in an air-conditioned room, stay out of the sun, and check up on relatives and neighbors. That's for eastern and central Washington and northern and north central Idaho. Locally, the forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area is calling for mostly clear conditions through tomorrow, low 63 tonight, high 104 tomorrow, widespread haze after noon, partly cloudy, low 65 Friday night, widespread haze before 9 p.m., partly cloudy Saturday, high 94, mostly cloudy Saturday night, low 66, and mostly sunny on Sunday, high 94. We'll continue with partly cloudy nights and mostly sunny days through Tuesday of next week with lows 63 Sunday night, 60 Monday night, and highs 96 Monday and 91 on Tuesday. Current temperature is 93. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website, krfp.org, to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. There you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. Flashpoints is up next, coming up at 7:30. Music from bands and musical artists that are coming into the area with appearing locally. Half-hour show. And at 8 o'clock, Maximum Rock and Roll. At 9 o'clock, the Academy's in to play music for you with the show Not Dark Yet. And then recorded jam band concerts with The Ride, 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. So stay tuned. KRFP, Moscow, Pullman.
KRFP is sponsored by Spectrum 2 Art and Dance Studios, specializing in art and dance classes for child
through adult. 525 South Main Street in Moscow. Information at 208-882-1445. UBU Dance Guru at msn.com or spectrum2studio.com. For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.